Welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, November the 2nd, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Here's our first story. It's entitled, The Bing at 100. Palmer's iconic candy marks milestone, early history poorly documented. It's written by Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal. Much of the early history of Sioux City's famed candy, the Bing, has been lost to the sands of time, like so many peanuts crushed into bits and eaten as a component of the chocolate and cherry mash treat. The identity of the person who came up with the Bing recipe? Unknown. The research and development that went into the Bing? Unrecorded. Given the time period, it's fair to presume this wasn't an elaborate process of focus groups and market research. The public's reaction to the Bing when it came on the market in 1923? They purchased enough of them to keep it a viable product. Nothing else is known. The origins of the name Bing? Unclear. Bing Crosby wasn't yet a household name, and there's no reason to doubt it had anything to do with the Bing variety of cherry. Quote, a lot of people assume, since it's a cherry product, it would be a Bing cherry because that's a type of cherry that people know, end quote, said Marty Palmer, president and CEO of Palmer Candy, the maker of Bing. He goes on to say, the trouble is, since we offered it in four different flavors, including maple and pineapple and vanilla, one of them being cherry, why would we have named it Bing? So it might have been just a fun name, end quote. We really don't know the origin of the name. Absent much real evidence, elements of the Bing's origins have been a sort of guessing game in the Palmer family, some versions of which attribute the Bing's origins to the Palmer firm's early years in the wholesale fruit business. Quote, the lore was always you could make the Bing cherries last a little longer if you coated them in chocolate, end quote, said Jim Palmer, Marty Palmer's nephew and the CEO of Tegra Corporation, who serves in an advisory role at Palmer Candy. He goes on to say, and one thing led to another, and obviously shelf life of a live Bing cherry inside chocolate isn't quite as good as the mash, and so, over time, it's converted to its standard format. Palmer this year is marking the 100th anniversary of its iconic Bing. The twin Bing, as the candy is better known now, wouldn't emerge until 50 years later, during a period of inflation that prompted the company to get creative with its portions and pieces. The company is commemorating the occasion the week of November the 6th with the rollout of a special birthday Bing, the traditional cherry center coated in a white with sprinkles birthday cake flavored peanut mixture, available that week for free at Palmer's Old Time Candy Shop, 405 Wesley Parkway. Quote, it's our intention to have a birthday party for the Bing, end quote, Marty Palmer said. A house fire brings new opportunities. Palmer Candy dates its founding to 1878, when Edward Cook Palmer's house in St. Joseph, Michigan burned down. Palmer moved his family to Sioux City and purchased the wholesale grocery business of H.D. Boog and Company. Seven years later, in the year 1855, Palmer sold the business to O.O. Tollerton and A.L. Stetson. 7 years after that, in the year 1892, E.C. Palmer's sons, Charles Edward Palmer and William B. Palmer, organized a new wholesale grocer, Palmer & Company. During this period, Palmer's trade region was far as a horse could go in a day, Marty Palmer said. Though their primary line was fruit, Palmer had been in the candy business for 25 years by the time Bing was developed. Their early confections consisted of chocolates, caramel, nougat, and salted peanuts, boxes of candy such as would be given to a Valentine, and bulk candies were top products then. By the time of the Bing's rollout, Marty Palmer said, the candy and fruit divisions of Palmer's business were probably equal in size. Quote, the candy company was the one that survived, end quote, Marty Palmer said. Their small regional fruit wholesaling business was a product of another generation, and it couldn't survive in the era of nationwide supermarket chains. The company exited the wholesale fruit market in the year 1969. It tailed off as time went on. The Dark Ages. Archival news accounts and print advertisements don't contribute much of anything to the history of the Bing. A handful of advertisements in the year 1923 mentioned Palmer selling boxes of wholesale cherries covered in chocolate, essentially a cherry cordial, but no product description matching that of the Bing during its first several decades could be found in newspaper archives. The first definite mention of the Bing in the journal didn't appear until the year 1958, when it was part of the weekly grocery specials, a box of 24 Bings for 89 cents at the Big Ten food store. An allusion to the Bing as a Sioux City product didn't appear in print until shortly before Halloween of the year 1964 in another weekly grocery specials ad. The Bing wasn't featured in a news article until 1980. Tom Munson, archives manager at the Sioux City Public Museum and one of the top authorities on the city's history, said he couldn't find much in the museum's archives related to the Bing's early history, except for a cardboard box of Bings believed to date to 1944. Quote, "There's not a lot, that individual brand name," Munson said. "We have all sorts of Palmer stuff, and we do have some things that were advertising Bings, but it's mostly very recent stuff." Of course, the Bing didn't emerge out of thin air. There are bits and pieces of its origin story that have been passed down through the generations. Quote, "It had a precursor called the Red Top, and the Red Top was really kind of the cherry Bing center, but it didn't have chopped peanuts. It had peanut halves over the top. And somebody in the year 1923 thought, let's do chopped peanuts and make a hash over the top," Marty Palmer said. "And that's where it was really created," end quote. A time of great innovation. What can be reasonably conjectured about the early history of the Bing is drawn from the broader history of candy at that time. The dominant chocolate products that survive to the present day, or at least a majority of the most familiar names, came on the market in the decades that followed the introduction of the Hershey's bar in 1900. Quote, "At the time, candy companies like ours were starting to field a whole bunch of different candy bars," Marty Palmer said. "Most of the candy bars that we're aware of today, whether it's the Milky Way or Mars bar or Butterfinger or Salted Nut Roll or whatever, most of them were created between 1910 and 1930. It was just a time of great innovation," end quote. The Bing was, in a sense, part of a throwing spaghetti at the wall strategy common to most American commerce. Palmer tried its hand at other brand name candies in this time period. There probably aren't many living today who remember the company's Kino bar or their Jack Frost marshmallows. Quote, "We put out something like 10 or 15 different candy bars, maybe 20 different candy bars, in hopes that one of them would stick," end quote, said Marty Palmer. And people do that today, right? Whether you're a big company or a small company, you're constantly launching products and you sort of hope that I launch 10 products, 5 of them make it 3 years, and one of them actually makes it a decade. And when you get one of those to really make it, to sell and to stay viable, you've just got a huge success. But most products don't make it today. That was the same back then, I'm sure, end quote. The Quinn Bing is born. Its father, inflation. Later events in the Bing story are better attested. The Bing found its twin in 1973. Consumer prices crept upward during the late 1960s, and the candy bar makers who still clung to the 5 cent price of yesteryear, including Palmer's Bing, were compelled to raise it to 10 cents. In the early 1970s, prices spiraled. Cocoa and sugar were not spared, and the Bing was headed for a 15-cent price tag, 3 times what a Bing cost a decade earlier. To soften the blow, Palmer decided to give the consumer twice the bang for their 15 cents, and the Twin Bing was born. Quote, "So we needed to do something, and the something was, let's give the customer double for their money," Marty Palmer said. "Let's take the single Bing, which is the way Bings had always been made and sold, and glue two of them together and make it a twin Bing," end quote. The King Bing came on the market in 1986 in response to the then fairly recent rollout of king-size candy bars by other companies. Quote, "The fact that the twin Bing, or a King Bing, is separable into humps, I know that there's a lot of people that like sharing, or they like eating one part of the candy bar and setting it down and coming back hours later," end quote, Marty Palmer said. Despite its association in the popular imagination with the Palmer Candy Company, the Bing has long accounted for only a small slice of Palmer's business. Quote, "We love the Bing, but it's not the biggest seller that we have," Marty Palmer acknowledged. The majority of Palmer's business is bulk candies, some of which bear the Palmer name, much of it carries private label names, and the wholesale repackaging of candies for retail. In these capacities, the company has relationships with some of the country's biggest and most familiar big box retailers. Quote, "If you're in a grocery store and you're buying candy with a grocery store name on it, it's quite possible that Palmer Candy made that candy," end quote, Marty Palmer said. He goes on to say, "Because the grocery store chain probably didn't, they don't have a candy factory somewhere. So that's another big part of our business. We do a lot of different things," end quote. Made by hand in Sioux City. The Bing is made by hand even in the present day. Most other major candy makers have long since automated their production. Quote, "As far as we know, it is the largest selling candy bar that is still handmade," Marty Palmer said. "So every Bing you buy has been lovingly put together," end quote. The Bing production process uses an ice cream scoop-like device. The cherry mash center is coated with chocolate, then put into the scoop, which is filled with the peanut hash, a mixture of chopped peanuts and chocolate. The Bing then goes down a cooling tunnel and then on to be wrapped. Quote, "One of the things that, as little kids, we just thought was the coolest thing in the world was it's made by hand, and we use ice cream scoops that have been converted into a double scoop for the Twin Bing and a triple for the King Bing," Jim Palmer said. "And I think, as a little kid, that was the coolest part," end quote. By this process, Palmer can manufacture up to 50,000 Bings in a day. Experiments with machine-made Bings in the past have produced unsatisfactory results. Quote, "We looked into mechanizing, automating some portions of the Bing production, and honestly, it didn't make the same product," Marty Palmer said. "I'm an engineer. This is one of the things that I would see as a goal and an opportunity, and we've developed equipment to do this, but it just doesn't make the Bing look like and taste like what people are used to," end quote. Staying power. The Bing is not a nationwide candy. Its trade region is essentially limited to part of the upper Midwest and the areas near the Rocky Mountains. Palmer has had difficulty breaking the Bing into more distant markets, due largely to the dominance of the industry's larger players and their vast marketing budgets. This, in turn, brought about a sort of homesickness-like phenomenon among Bing connoisseurs in other places. Jim Palmer said he didn't particularly enjoy Bings as a child, but things changed when he went away to college in Colorado, where only one drugstore carried Bings. Quote, "I had to move away to college where we couldn't get them as often, and came back, and all of a sudden, I guess absence made the heart grow fonder," end quote, Jim Palmer said. It's a common enough occurrence, Marty Palmer said, and one the company is well acquainted with. Quote, "If you were raised in this region, anywhere where the Bing is sold, say in 500 miles or so, and then you move to another part of the country, the first thing that they do is call back to the family that's still here and have them send them Bings," end quote, Marty Palmer said. He goes on to say, "Or it's a favorite Christmas present for somebody who's moved to Phoenix or moved to LA or moved to Florida and they can't get their Bings. They either order cartons online or they have their family members send them," end quote. The Bing's true fans are a devoted bunch, to the extent that the Twin Bing now has its own branded merchandise, including apparel, keychains, and salt and pepper shakers. Chris Wilson, a Dakota Dunes woman who makes zippered purses out of old candy wrappers, said last year that her Twin Bing wrapper creations have been especially popular. "It's a huge following. I mean, people that like Bings and are passionate about Bings are very passionate about Bings," end quote, Marty Palmer said. "They won't look at another similar product." In a related article, whatever happened to the other Bings? Maple, pineapple, and vanilla didn't make the cut. This also was written by Mason Doctor. As is the case with nearly everything about the Bing in the 1920s, little is known of the fate of the other three original flavors, maple, vanilla, and pineapple, except that they were discontinued. It is unclear when or why this occurred. but it's reasonable to think they only made it a few years. Quote, we put it out in four flavors, said Marty Palmer, president and CEO of Palmer Candy, and then it got resolved into just the cherry. From that point on, it's been a solid camper all the way through, end quote. It's possible, Palmer said, quote, that the pineapple and the maple and the vanilla actually sold pretty well, but the cherry was a little bit stronger, end quote, so it survived while the others perished. But nothing is known for certain. Quote, I have to believe that they might have made it a few years, because nobody launches a product and then deserts it after a week or a month or a year, end quote, Palmer added, of the long-lost flavors. He goes on to say, you keep poking away at it, and it could have been that the retailers at the time, this would be true of our retailers today, would say, you know, I like this product, but I only have a spot on my shelf for one, end quote. In latter days, Palmer Candy went on to introduce other special flavors and additions of the Bing. Pineapple came back for a limited time years ago as the Tropical Bing, along with perennial S'mores variety, the annual Patriotic Bing, a red, white, and blue affair for the summer season, and the Caramel Bing. There's the S'mores Bing was introduced about 2 years ago, and the caramel variety roughly 3 years ago. Quote, through the years, we've tried different flavors. We had a peanut butter Bing. We had a pineapple Bing, Marty Palmer said, end quote. The Bing has also made cameo appearances in non-candy products. In the year 2020, Sioux Falls Fernson Brewing Company rolled out a 30-barrel batch of Twin Bing Stout, a beer collaboration with Palmer that took its cues from the candy. Ironically, Palmer itself was at one time a somewhat prolific beer distributor. In the 1920s, it had a distribution deal on non-alcoholic Pabst Blue Ribbon, and by the time Prohibition ended in 1933, the company had landed a lucrative distribution deal with Schlitz, then a top-selling beer. The Twin Bing beer had been under development for a year or so, going through 15 test recipes to achieve what Marty Palmer described at the time as a balance between cocoa, nut, and fruity flavors, so it would reflect the flavors of the Twin Bing. That same year, Twin Bing Ice Cream, a collaboration between Palmer and the Stensland Family Farms Creamery of Larchwood, Iowa, was unveiled. The following year, Palmer teamed up with Rosie's Coffee Roasting Company on a Twin Bing coffee, which, like the beer, took its flavor cues from the Bing's chocolate, nut, and cherry taste. Quote, we've tried a lot of more playful things with the Bing brand, Marty Palmer said, in 2020, when the Bing Stout was unveiled. In other local news, sheriff wants to buy armored vehicle after shooting. This is written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan says he is hoping to purchase an armored vehicle for the county after a Sunday night shooting at a farm near Hornick, Iowa. Sheehan said without the support of nearby law enforcement agencies and their willingness to lend their armored vehicles, there would have been multiple law enforcement casualties. Quote, if it was not for the assistance we received, we would be planning funerals for our deputies, he said. Had we just gone in there like normal, it would have been fatal, end quote. Around 7:30 p.m. Sunday, officers received a 911 call reporting a shooting that occurred on Old Highway 141 near Hornick, Iowa. Todd C. Sulzberger, age 72, told dispatchers that his son was shooting at him on his farm. Deputies responded to the area, setting up a perimeter at the farm. The suspect, Walter M. Sulzberger, age 44, killed his father and told police there would be no peaceful resolution, Sheehan said. Walter Sulzberg spoke with the sheriff's department negotiator for nearly 7 hours, and when tactical teams approached, he fired at them. The team returned fire, shooting and killing Walter Sulzberger. Sheehan said, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation will determine the official cause of death and whether it was justified. Sheehan told the Board of Supervisors on Tuesday he wanted to publicly thank the departments that responded to the scene and provided assistance. He said the Sioux City Police Department, Iowa State Patrol, and the Tri-County CERT team sent their respective armored vehicles and tactical personnel. He said the vehicles were under heavy fire from a person who was well-equipped and knew what they were doing. The broadcast from inside the armored vehicles sounded like being in a car in the middle of a hailstorm, Sheehan said. He added a combat veteran said it sounded like he was back in Baghdad. While he is not able to share the amount of rounds the vehicle took, Sheehan said he was shocked by the number. No officers were injured in the shooting. Sheehan said for years the deputies have been requesting an armored vehicle, and for years they've been held at bay. Now that this situation has occurred, the department is going to be looking into what they need and how to get one, because this will not be the last time a situation like this occurs, Sheehan said. The cost is around $300,000, he said. Quote, we are going to do everything we can to try and utilize whatever sources of income that we can to try and purchase one of these vehicles, end quote, he said. Additionally, they plan to look everywhere, including private citizen donations, grants, endowments, etc. Chief Deputy Tony Wingert said the department will get an armored vehicle and he will make the necessary requests and sacrifices necessary to do it. The world is not getting any nicer, he said. When questioned why the county needs an armored vehicle when other agencies in the area are willing to provide theirs, Sheehan said that might not always be the case and they may not be available. He said in this situation, all three armored vehicles were needed. Quote, you take any one or two of them away, it would have still put us in a tactical disadvantage, he said. He goes on to say, by us having it, we know we have it, and for some things that may not be that large, we would still be using that armored vehicle, end quote. Sheehan said that the request would be brought forward to the board soon. The supervisors thanked the sheriff's department and other county departments that assisted in the situation. Woodbury County Board of Supervisors considers hiring outside counsel. This is written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors is discussing hiring a law firm to represent them in seeking damages due to the delayed law enforcement center project. For the past few weeks, the supervisors have discussed recouping money lost due to the delay in completing the new jail. Next week, the supervisors are hoping to receive input from the county attorney's office on the topic. On Tuesday, Supervisors Jeremy Taylor and Keith Radig suggested the board hire John A. Templar Jr. of Whitfield and Eddy Law to represent the county in issues related to the construction of the facility. Taylor and Radig said the process needs to be expedited as it has already been 2 months without representation. Any voting on the contract was deferred. Supervisor Matthew Ung expressed he believed it was a bad idea to put the item on the agenda without information from the county attorney's office or board discussions on what they are seeking representation for. The new law enforcement center project was to be completed on September the 14th, but it was discovered that 38 fire dampers were missing from the building, pushing the projected completion date to the proposed April 9th, 2024. The added construction time is projected to add nearly $1.8 million to a project that's already cost nearly $70 million. The county has budgeted $1.2 million in revenue for the current fiscal year through June 2024 by housing federal inmates in the new jail. For the past 2 weeks, the board has discussed finding representation for the issue. Currently, the board overseeing the project, the Law Enforcement Center Authority, signed a letter of agreement with Frederickson and Byron, PA, in August to provide legal services regarding the Law Enforcement Center project. It was previously suggested that Jody McDougall of Frederickson, Byron, PA, represent both the county and the authority. Taylor said when looking into Frederickson and Byron, he was told the attorney representing the LEC authority, Jody McDougall, often represents the Baker Group. The conflict of interest was waived in the contract. Taylor said he was previously advised the Board of Supervisors and the LEC authority could be jointly represented by McDougall. Board members, they did not want that. And last week, the board said McDougall said she thought it would be best to not represent the authority and the county given the hesitation and concerns raised by the board. Taylor said he has been asking for legal counsel on a variety of LEC matters for the last 2 months. for matters related to the project, such as construction, maintenance, contracts, and bonds, Taylor said the board was told outside counsel was needed. County Attorney James Loomis said it would be best for the county to hire outside counsel for the issue. He said he was looking at a couple of different options during the October 24th meeting and advised the board to agree on who the counsel is unanimously so that everyone is on the same page, he said. Ung said shortly after that meeting, Taylor sent him the contract with Templar dated October 17th, asking for it to be put on this week's agenda. Ung said the optics of the situation are bad. Ung said he did not like that the item was put on the agenda and did not think it was a good thing. One of the articles on today's opinion page comes from the Wall Street Journal, and it's entitled, "The High Court Faces a Social Media Question." Some lower courts have divined that in the First Amendment's penumbra, a right to follow politicians on social media. The court is considering whether the Constitution bars public officials from blocking constituents on their personal accounts. Michelle O'Connor Ratcliffe and T.J. Zane, elected school board members in California, used personal Facebook and Twitter accounts they created while running for office to campaign and inform constituents about education news. The officials blocked two parents for making repetitious and non-responsive comments on their pages. The blocked parent sued, arguing the board members abridged their speech rights. The school district didn't control the social media accounts or spend money to maintain them, but the parents said the board members' job-related communications converted the pages into de facto public forums. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, ruling that members acted under color or state law because they clothed their pages in the authority of their offices and used their pages to communicate about their official duties. Several appellate courts have adopted the Ninth Circuit's appearance and content test for determining when public officials are engaging in state action when they block constituents on personal accounts. But this test lacks a clear basis in the Constitution or the Supreme Court's state action precedents. Such a broad interpretation of state action would infringe on the First Amendment rights of government officials by restricting how they can communicate with the public. James Freed argues this point in a second case before the High Court. Freed created his Facebook account while in college more than 15 years ago, when he was hired as the city manager of Port Huron, Michigan in 2014. He opened up his page to the public, including posts about his personal life and public announcements. When Kevin Lindke, a city resident, posted disparaging remarks on Freed's personal page, Freed blocked him. Lindke sued Freed for violating his speech rights. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals tossed the lawsuit, holding that a public official engages in state action only when performing a legally mandated duty of his office or invoking the authority of his office. Though Freed sometimes posted about his job, he was acting in his personal capacity, and there was no state action, the Sixth Circuit held. The High Court now has an opportunity to clarify its standard. As the Justice Department argues in its amicus brief, the Ninth Circuit's interpretation could subject much of the speech of public officials and employees to constitutional restrictions that would make those officials and employees less willing to speak in the first place and reduce, not enhance, free speech and public discourse. Americans have many platforms to criticize public officials without invading their personal social media pages. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, Alice Adele Crandall of Sioux City, age 93, passed away on October the 29th, 2023 at Maple Heights Nursing Home. Visitation will take place at 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November the 2nd, 2023, at Meyer Brothers Funeral Home, 3220 Stone Park Boulevard. Services will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, November 3, 2023, at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, 1201 West Clifton Avenue, Sioux City, followed by interment at Graceland Park Cemetery. Alice, daughter of Gilbert and Emma Rosenbaum Coates, was born September 4, 1930 in North Bend, Nebraska. Throughout her life, she was a loving, hard-working mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. She was happiest when hosting family dinners. Her home was filled with love and happiness. Alice was preceded in death by her parents, a sister, Florence Gorley, and brother, Leroy Beckler. Next, Kyle Nathan Dykus of Sioux City, aged 32, passed away October 25, 2023 at a local hospital. There will be a private family service at a later date. Arrangements in care of direction of Nelson Berger Northside Chapel, www.meyerbroschapels.com. Carolyn E. Wolpert, aged 79 of Sioux City, passed away Monday, October 30th, 2023 at a local care facility. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 11th at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary at 6:45 p.m. and a vigil service to follow at 7 p.m. all at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. www.meyerbrotherschapel.com. Lloyd J. Schoenrock Jr. of Smith, age 70, of Smithland, passed away unexpectedly on Friday, October 27, 2023. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Tuesday, November the 7th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel in Sioux City, with burial following at Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will greet friends from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, November the 6th, 2023 at the funeral home. Jesse Dean Reed, age 40, of Sioux City, passed away October 28, 2023. Services pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Gail J. Lees, age 74, of Kingsley, passed away unexpectedly Thursday, October 26, 2023 at her residence. A celebration of life will be held 2 to 6 p.m. Saturday, November the 4th at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Gail was born on October the 8th, 1949, in Kingsley, the daughter of William E. and Ruth Black Knisley. Gail grew up in Kingsley, graduating from high school in 1967. Gail was preceded in death by her parents. Dennis Edward Rankin, age 76, of Kingsley, passed away Monday, October the 30th. Following a courageous battle with Alzheimer's. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, November the 3rd at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley with a 7 p.m. prayer service. A celebration of life will take place at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November the 4th at Salem Lutheran Church in rural Correctionville, Iowa. The family requests in lieu of flowers that memorials will be directed to Salem Lutheran Church or to the Alzheimer's Association. Vernon Willie D. Chedister, age 93, of Sioux City, died Friday, October 27th, in Sioux City. A visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November the 2nd, 2023, at Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue, with a prayer service at 6:30 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Friday, November the 3rd, 2023, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Sioux City, with burial to follow in Graceland Park Cemetery. William Bill Weyerts Kugler was born July 6, 1929, in Wayne County to Henry and Margaret Weyerts Kugler. He graduated from Wayne High School and attended Wayne State College and Norfolk Business College. Bill generously donated his body to science, and his memorial service will be scheduled at a later date. Memorials may be designated to Our Savior Lutheran Church, Friends of Music Scholarship at Wayne State College, and the Wayne Volunteer Fire Department. Helen Katz Sterling of Virginia Beach passed away peacefully at her home October 27, 2023, after a long and beautiful life. She was 95 years old. Funeral services were held on October the 30th in Norfolk at Forest Lawn Cemetery. H.D. Oliver Funeral Apartments handled the arrangements. Helen was born in Lithuania on February 19, 1928, the youngest of five children of Aaron and Esther Katz. The family moved to Portsmouth, Virginia in 1939, just prior to the start of World War II. She married cantor Harry Sterling in 1958 before starting a family in Utah. Daughter Debbie and son David were born in Salt Lake City prior to moving to Sioux City. They were an integral part of Sioux City Jewish community and thoroughly enjoyed their years there. They remained in Sioux City until moving back to Virginia in 1985 to be closer to Helen's family. The family requests that, if desired, contributions be made to Congressional Beth El or a charity of your choice. Online condolences may be shared with the family at www.hdoliver.com. Paulina N. Cruzmark, of age 96, of Emerson, died on Monday, October the 30th, 2023, at Heritage of Emerson Nursing Home in Emerson. A massive Christian burial will be held on Saturday, November the 4th, 2023, at 10 a.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery in Emerson. The visitation will be held on Friday, November the 23rd, 2023, from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Church of Emerson. Burial will be in the Calvary Catholic Church Cemetery in Emerson. Memorials are suggested to the family for future designation. Munderlow Smith Funeral Home of Emerson is in charge of arrangements. And Anita L. Small, age 85, of Sioux City, passed away on Sunday, October the 29th, 2023, after a long and strong battle with various medical issues. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November the 4th, 2023, at St. Michael Catholic Church in Sioux City. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. with the vigil service at 7 p.m. on Friday evening at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Online condolences may be directed to www.meyerbroschapel.com. Memorial donations may be directed to the family for future designation. That concludes our obituaries, and now we turn our attention to sports and the top story. Wolfpack return to state title game. The Western Christian sweeps Union in semifinals and first season in 3A. This is written by Ryan Timmerman, and the dateline is Coralville, Iowa. Seven seniors gone from last season's Class 2A state champion, a move up to 3A. No problem. The Western Christian High School volleyball team is back in the state championship after outlasting two-time defending champion Dyke New Hartford in five sets for the 2A title last year. To get to the 3A finals, the third-seeded Wolfpack dispatched seventh-seeded Union in straight sets in Wednesday's semifinal round, 25-14, 25-20, and 25-17 at Extreme Arena in Coralville. Quote, being here before is a strength of ours, end quote, said Western Christian head coach Tammy Verbeek. Those whose squad made it to at least the semifinals for the 24th straight season. Quote, that experience is huge. The girls have been here before, grew up watching their sisters, cousins, and those that came before them get here. Now it's their opportunity, and that's irreplaceable, end quote. Though both sides would go on an extended runs during the 3A state semifinal match, the decisive third set was emblematic of both that came before it, though perhaps the most dramatic. Western Christian was forced to use a timeout after Union took an 11-10 lead, the latest in any of the three sets that the Knights led. But the Wolfpack responded with a barrage of kills and blocks by seniors Shayna Van Dyken and Kiana Winja. Bentley Blyke added one during that span to put the Wolfpack up 17-12. Quote, I'm super excited for tomorrow, end quote, Van Dyken said. She goes on to say, the coaching here is always determined to get us back to the state championship, and the girls on the team have really come together throughout the season. Having some seniors that played last year helps. We play a lot of tough teams in the regular season. Those teams are a different level. We take some losses, though, and that gets us ready for the playoffs here. We learned a lot from it, end quote. The middle set saw Western Christian go up 9-2 before Union got to within 6 at 16-10. The Wolfpack opened it back up to 19-10. Western Christian, with a record of 31-13, got off to a hot start and led 12-4 out of the gate, then added a Bentley Blake kill to add a point. Blake ended with 9 kills and 14 digs. Senior libero Haley Wielenga led the match in digs with 31, and senior setter Brea Van Clee had 28 assists, one fewer than Union had as a team. Blake, a sophomore outside hitter, went for 13 kills. Senior Kiana Winja had the match high with 15. Quote, "This program is so special," said Winja, the lone returning starter from last season's Class 2A champion. "Every team is a little different, but no matter who's on the team, we just love each other so much. It's a family here. We play for each other, and we love playing the game. Switching to a new class, we felt a little nervous, but it's went well so far. I don't think it's made a lot of difference," end quote. But Union, with a record of 39-11, battled back, eventually pulling to 3 at 15-12 and again at 16-13, but it was all Wolfpack from there. Western Christian scored 5 straight points with sophomore Scarlett Winterfield serving and finished off the set, only allowing the Knights to score once more. The Wolfpack beat 6th-seeded Union in 4 sets in the quarterfinals to reach the semi. CPU upset 2nd-seeded Cherokee in straight sets to move on. With 13 losses on the season, Western Christian has among the most of any team at the state tournament, but Western Christian doesn't play in a conference, instead opting to fill its schedule with tournaments that pit the Wolfpack against the top teams, not only from any and all classes in Iowa, but some of the top teams in South Dakota and Nebraska. That makes the Wolfpack uniquely battle-tested come playoffs. Quote, "We played several defending state champions from a few states this season," end quote, said Verbeek. We went through some growing pains because we're a young, inexperienced team, but we've really come together. But we're zoned in now. We tell them all the time that they had to learn from the losses. It stings. We don't like to lose at Western Christian, but it's about what they do about it and how they use it to get better. Next up is an article entitled Warriors Crusaders Vie for Trip to Dome. In 3A quarterfinals, Helan looks to avenge loss to Sioux Center. This is written by Dave Driesen. An explosive offense helped propel Bishop Helan Catholic to a 9-win season and the team's first appearance in the state playoffs since 2018. In their 9 wins, the Crusaders averaged over 42 points per game while rolling up over 240 yards per game on the ground and over 100 yards through the air. But Sioux Center's stout defense bottled up Helan's potent offense in the Crusaders' only loss of the season, 21-0, on September the 22nd. The Crusaders will look to move the chains and find the end zone in Friday's rematch in Sioux Center. The winner of the Class 3A quarterfinal game will earn a trip to the semifinals at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls next week. Both teams pulled out close wins in the first round of the playoffs last week. After trailing Algona 21-0 after the first quarter, Sioux Center mounted a remarkable comeback to win 21-14. Helan never trailed at Clear Lake last week, taking a commanding 22-6 lead at halftime. But the Lions came roaring back with 2 second-half touchdowns to cut the deficit to 22-19 late in the fourth quarter. After picking up a couple first downs, Helan was able to run out the clock and hold on for the win. Senior quarterback Quinn Olson had a hand in all 3 touchdowns, running for 2 scores and throwing for another. For the season, the dual-threat signal caller leads the Crusaders in rushing with 811 yards and 13 touchdowns and passing with over 1,000 yards and 18 more scores. Senior Sir Brandon Watts is Olson's favorite target with 18 catches for 316 yards and 6 touchdowns. Helan's offensive line will be a key Friday night to protecting Olson and creating running lanes for him, and the running attack, which also features Ricky Fiodo, Kaysen Thomas, and Watts. In the September 22nd game, Sioux Center's defensive front limited the Crusaders to 106 yards rushing on 26 attempts. Olson was 13 of 24 passing for 150 yards and an interception. Leading the Warriors D is senior linebacker Reed Holsoff, who has 52 tackles, including 33 solo and 5 for loss. Senior defensive end Carson Brunn has a team-high 10 tackles for loss, including 4 sacks. Brunn, a Kansas Jayhawk recruit as a tight end, also has a team-high 22 catches for 258 yards and 4 touchdowns. Senior quarterback Brody Van Regenmorter has completed 67 of 141 passes for 1,060 yards for 10 touchdowns and 4 interceptions. In last week's win over Algona, Van Regenmorter passed for 203 yards and a touchdown and added 47 on the ground. Solomon T. rushed for 137 yards on 31 carries and reached the end zone twice. Helens defense, which will look to shut down the Warriors Friday night, is led by senior Max Delaney, who has 40 and a half tackles, including 27 solo and 2.5 for a loss. Junior Will Petit has 38 and a half tackles, including 21 solo and 3 for loss, and has also recovered 3 fumbles. Olson has picked off 4 passes from his defensive back position, returning 1 for a touchdown. Sioux Center is riding a 10-game winning streak after losing its season opener to West Lyon 14-2. The Wildcats, with a record of 9-1, travel to Spirit Lake for a Class 2A corner final contest Friday night. Helin has regular season wins over 2 playoff qualifiers, 29-21 over Class 5A Sioux City East on September the 8th, and 22-19 over Class 2A Carroll Kemper Catholic on August 25th. Let's take a look at what sports are available today on television. 6 p.m. on FS1 is college football, TCU at Texas Tech. 6:30 p.m. on ESPN, it's Wake Forest at Duke. ESPN2 is South Alabama at Troy. And on ESPNU, it's Mississippi Valley State versus Bethune Cookman. College men's soccer, 5:30 p.m. on Pac-12 Network. It's UCLA at California. At 9 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, it's San Diego State at Stanford. Women's soccer, at 4 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. Big Ten Tournament, Wisconsin versus Nebraska. And at 4:30 p.m. on ACC Network, the Atlantic Coast Tournament, Clemson versus Notre Dame. 5 p.m. on SECN, it's Southeastern Tournament, Mississippi State versus Arkansas. 6:30 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's Iowa versus Penn State. 7 p.m. on the ACCN, it's the Atlantic Coast Tournament, Pittsburgh versus Florida State. And at 7:30 p.m. on SECN, it's Southeastern Tournament, Texas A&M versus Georgia. NBA basketball, 6 p.m. on NBA TV. It's Toronto, at Philadelphia. At 9 p.m. on NBA TV, it's San Antonio at Phoenix. And tonight's Thursday night football game is at 7:15 p.m. on Prime Video, and it's the Tennessee Titans versus the Pittsburgh Steelers. In other local sports, EPJ travels to Winner for rematch. For shot at second straight title, Huskies must get past Warriors. This is written by Dave Driesen. In a rematch of last season's state championship game, Elk Point Jefferson and Winner collide Friday night with the Winner earning a return trip to the Dakota Dome. EPJ upset Winner 21-14 in the 2022 Class 11B title game, giving the consolidated school their first state championship in football. The Huskies capped an undefeated season and derailed the Warriors' bid for a third straight crown. Despite heavy losses to graduation, EPJ has reached the 11B semifinals for the third straight year. 2 years ago, the Huskies traveled to Winner for the semis, only to get thumped 52-14. In last week's quarterfinals, the Huskies edged Tri-Valley 14-7, breaking a fourth quarter tie with a 45-yard pick six by Ashton Fairbanks. Winner advanced by blanking Aberdeen Roncalli 28-0. Winner, hosting its fifth straight semifinal game, went undefeated for the fifth straight season. The Warriors outscored their opponents 368-45 this season, averaging over 36 points per game, while pitching six shutouts. The Warriors' only scare came during a season-opening 8-0 win over Tri-Valley. Elk Point Jefferson has beaten Tri-View twice this season, the first by 24-14 score on October the 6th regular season contest. The Huskies' only loss was a 22-11 to Sioux Valley, which finished the regular season undefeated before losing to Hot Springs in the quarterfinals last week. Hot Springs hosts Rapid City Christian in the other 11B semifinal Friday. In his first season as the EPJ starting quarterback, Keaton Gale has completed 81 of 141 passes for 1,331 yards and 17 touchdowns. The junior also has rushed for 364 yards and two scores. His older brother, senior Jake Gale, leads the Huskies in rushing with 618 yards and 10 TDs. Senior Garrett Merkley is the second leading rusher with 463 yards and 8 TDs, and the leading receiver with 18 catches for 284 yards and 3 scores. In the win over Tri-Valley, Merkley had 65 rushing yards on just 5 carries, keeping the chains moving on several drives. Aiden Barfus led the Warriors' attack with 106 rushing yards on 15 carries with one touchdown in last week's win over Aberdeen Roncalli. Carson Kaiser added 97 yards rushing and a touchdown. The EPJ defense will seek to slow down Winner's powerful ground game. Grayson Girard and Jake Gale lead the Huskies in tackles with 31.5 and 28.5, respectively. In high school football, here's a look at Friday night's quarterfinal games involving area teams in Class 2A, 1A, and Single A. Class 2A, Kemper Carroll Catholic, with a record in 8-2, is at Central Lyons / George Little Rock, with a record of 9-0. Also in Class 2A, West Lyon, with a record of 9-1, is at Spirit Lake, with a record of 9-1. That game kicks off 7 p.m. Friday in Spirit Lake. In Class 1A, Underwood, with a record of 9-1, is at OABCIG, with a record of 8-2. Kickoff is at 7 p.m. in Ida Grove. In Class Single A, Logan Magnolia, with a record of 9-1, is at Woodbury Central, with a record of 10-0. That game kicks off 7 p.m. Friday in Mobile. Raiders earn top volleyball seed. Northwestern, Concordia, and Jamestown share regular season crown. Northwestern has earned the top seed for the GPAC volleyball tournament after sharing regular season title with Concordia and Jamestown. The three teams each finished with a 14-2 league record. The tiebreaker was used to award the Red Raiders the top seed in the GPAC regular season and automatic berth to the NAIA National Women's Volleyball Championships. Concordia is the 2 seed and Jamestown is the 3rd seed for the GPAC tournament, which starts with quarterfinal matches on Saturday. The top 8 teams qualified for postseason tourney. Additional seedings and regular season league records include number 4 Midland with a record of 10-6, number 5 College of St. Mary with a record of 10-6, number 6 Morningside with a record of 8-8, number 7 Dakota Wesleyan with a record of 8-8, and number 8 Doan with a record of 6-10. With first round pairings on Saturday, Doan at Northwestern at 7 p.m., College of St. Mary at Midland at 7 p.m., Morningside at Jamestown at 7 p.m. and Dakota Wesleyan at Concordia at 7:30 p.m. Semifinals will be played November the 8th, and the finals are set for November the 11th, with the highest remaining seeds hosting each match. The GPAC tournament winner or runner-up, if Northwestern wins, also will receive an automatic berth to the 48-team national tournament. All teams play in opening round matches on campus sites on November the 18th. The opening round winners will advance to 24-team pool play at the NAIA National Championship November 29th through December 5th at the Tyson Events Center in Sioux City. And DVEPJ sweep opening matches. Panthers and Huskies to meet in volleyball quarterfinals on Thursday. The Dakota Valley and Elk Point Jefferson volleyball teams swept their opening round matches in the Class A playoffs Tuesday night, setting up a quarterfinal tilt between the two Southeast South Dakota rivals. The Panthers, with a record of 18-10, and the Huskies, with a record of 25-9, will meet at 7 p.m. Thursday at Dakota Valley High School. Dakota Valley, the second seed in the Region 4, quickly dispatched Parker in three sets, 25-18, 25-7, and 25-7. Elk Point Jefferson, the number 3 seed, cruised past Vermilion in three sets, 25-18, 25-13, and 25-21. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.